From the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins. Sitting in today for Tony is our own Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships for Family Research Council.
Welcome to the Wednesday edition of Washington Watch. I am Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships here at Family Research Council, sitting in for Tony on this Wednesday afternoon. According to a new explosive New York Times article, pictures of child sexual abuse have long produced and shared to satisfy twisted adult obsessions, but it has never been like this. Technology companies reported a record 45 million online photos and videos of the abuse last year. That's a quote from the article. And in just a moment, I'll have a sobering conversation with Pat Truman, the former chief of the Child Exploitation and Obscenity Section, Criminal Division at the Department of Justice. He now serves as president of the National Center on Sexual Exploitation. In my second segment, the University of Iowa officials are being held personally liable for patent religious discrimination as a federal court ordered the university to let religious student groups like University Christian Fellowship stay on campus. I'll talk with Daniel Blomberg, an attorney with Beckett Law, coming up. At the bottom of the hour, a beloved Williamsburg, Virginia French teacher was fired for not using a female student's preferred male pronouns. The teacher is now suing the school district for $1 million after having lost his job. I'll talk with Caleb Dalton, the ADF attorney who is representing him. And at 42 past the hour, I'll talk with Michelle Malkin, who has written a new book entitled Open Borders, Who's Funding America's Destruction? Michelle's mantra is follow the money, follow the truth. And in her stunning new book, she puts to work that mantra with a shocking deep dive dossier of the funders and foot soldiers of immigration anarchy here and around the globe. And what she found will shock and surprise you. As a reminder, our podcast website is tonyperkins.com. Follow Tony on Twitter at tperkins or me, if you'd care to, at Sarah P. Perry. We are simply days away now from our Values Voter Summit. For more information, speakers, events, schedule, and registration for those of you who would like to do things last minute, valuesvotersummit.org is the website. Well, in a 5,300-word article, the New York Times devoted substantial space to an article last week entitled The Internet is Overrun with Images of Child Sexual Abuse. What Went Wrong? Michael Keller and Gabriel Dance write, quote, the images are horrific. Children, some just 3 or 4 years old, being sexually abused and in some cases tortured. Pictures of child sexual abuse have long been produced and shared to satisfy twisted adult obsessions. But it has never been like this. Technology companies reported a record of 45 million online photos and videos of the abuse last year, end quote. Joining me now is Pat Truman, president at the National Center on Sexual Exploitation. He spearheads efforts to address the intersectionality between all forms of sexual exploitation, including the public health crisis of pornography, the demand for commercial sexual exploitation, and the abuse of children. Under his leadership, the NCOSE has produced policy improvements at a wide range of notable institutions, including Google, Walmart, the Department of Justice, Verizon, the FCC, and more. Mr. Truman is the former chief of the Child Exploitation and Obscenity Section, Criminal Division, at the U.S. Department of Justice from 88 to 93. And while there, he supervised the prosecution of child sex crimes, child pornography, and obscenity, managing an office of prosecutors and working with the nation's 93 U.S. attorneys. Pat, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thank you very much, Sarah. Good to be back.
Pat, I have to tell you, I read this article, and as a mother of three children, one of whom is only 10 years old, it turned my stomach. More than a decade ago, when the reported number of pictures and videos of child sex abuse was less than a million, the proliferation of the explicit imagery has now reached what I think all of us would consider to be a crisis point. So we've got tech companies, law enforcement agencies, and legislators all responding. Landmark legislation passed in 2008, but the explosion is still growing. So how can we account for such an exponential explosion in this horrifically abusive content?
Well, Sarah, there's enough blame to go around, but this was all predictable. There's no surprise in the fact that we are overwhelmed with child pornography on the internet, and that we have entrapped, rightfully so, people who are, adults, people who are children who are downloading this stuff. We have an overwhelming problem, so that the Justice Department of the United States and other law enforcement agencies don't even try to prosecute those who have child pornography images of older children. They're just now trying to work on the prepubescent children. It's a crisis that's out of control, but like I said, it's all predictable.
All right, so let's talk a little bit about the numbers here, because they are pretty staggering. The New York Times pointed out that in 1998, there were over 3,000 reports of child sexual abuse imagery. But just over 10 years later, the reports soared past 100,000. In 2014, they passed a million. And last year, there were 18.4 million images, more than a third of the total ever reported, including 45 million videos, images flagged as sexual abuse. And the Justice Department was given a major role by Congress to take a look at these, to follow these reports, to catalog the data. But they didn't even write mandatory monitoring reports. And what surprises me, no senior executive level official led a crackdown, and the oversights are absolutely glaring, aren't they?
Well, they are, but here's the problem. Years ago, when I did head that office at the U.S. Department of Justice Criminal Division, prosecuting all pornography, adult and child, we always maintained that you have to prosecute adult pornography if you're going to also try to stamp out child pornography. Because if you have a free-for-all on adult pornography, what we know about the brain science is that people get addicted to pornography, and then they look for harder and more deviant material, because you get bored with the kind of material you're looking at. Topless photos of women get boring to a person after a day or so. They want harder and more deviant. And eventually people move from one genre to another, and then they aren't excited about it, and they go to child pornography. Every investigator of child pornography can tell you that this phenomenon takes place. Anybody worth their salt, that is, can tell you that this takes place. But the Justice Department, back when I left the office in 1993, we had virtually stamped out child pornography in America. Of course, the internet came after that. But the Justice Department, at the same time that the internet came about, that is in the Clinton administration, decided to just look the other way on adult pornography. So then you had all these websites, Pornhub and all the others, flooding the internet, so that the most popular sites on the internet today, almost all of them, are pornography sites. And you have a whole world of pornography devoured by our young people from, the age 12, 13, 14. And now they're adults, and they get bored with what they see. And so many of those have turned to child pornography. So what the Justice Department needed to do is recognize that pornography, whether it's adult or child, is causing a public health a crisis in America, and address all of it. But now, because they haven't addressed adult pornography at all, then they stop prosecuting child pornography if it's an image of a girl 14, 15, 16, 17. And as you see from this article, many of these law enforcement agencies won't even prosecute unless you actually have an image of someone sexually abusing a child. They are, because they can't handle the millions of other images that are being created out there. So the problem has been they've looked the other way on so much of this, particularly the adult pornography. We've got a sexualized society. It's a free-for-all, and now we have a crisis on our hands.
Well, and now on top of that, you are dealing with better and more savvy technology to encrypt the images, to hide them. That presents a real problem for a lot of these major social media platforms. Like, for example, I'm thinking of Facebook and Zuckerberg's promise to start encrypting their messaging, when in fact he also recognizes out of the other side of his mouth that, yes, this kind of technology can be abused. So there's a large part of this, too, that really we're subjected to the function of hideability, aren't we?
Oh, yes, we are, and Google is going to take this a step further. This has got a lot of us upset, and we've tried to wake up Congress to this fact. Google and its allies, Mozilla and Cloudflare, are going to encrypt all search activity on the browsers so that all of the material that people search for will be hidden. Just imagine what that is going to do to law enforcement. So law enforcement can no longer, when it does searches someone's home who they believe is a child pornographer, distributing or producing child pornography, sending it out on their computer, they go and search that person's premises, capture the computer, and they look at it, but there's no websites that they can find. Why? Because Google's going to put all that behind a wall. And this has got a lot of companies upset, Comcast and others, who are on the right side of child protection, are raising an alarm about this. And certainly the National Center on Sexual Exploitation is doing that. We're going to have, in fact, a symposium on Capitol Hill coming up next month to talk about just this type of thing. We are getting further and further away from child protection on the Internet because of this encryption issue.
So we've got about a minute left here, but I want to talk just in this last period here of our interview, the problem of child sex abuse imagery. It's got a particular hurdle, and they represented this in the Times article. Is this a situation in which we just need sufficient funding to track down these perverts, build a case, and throw them in jail? This is a big question with what I'm sure needs to be a very big answer, but how do we begin?
Well, now that we're in this mess, we do need much more funding. But we do need to have law enforcement agencies, particularly the Justice Department, recognize that any illegal images of pornography have to be prosecuted. Companies like Pornhub are operating illegally, even though it's mostly adult pornography. So you have to prosecute all of it. It's the broken window theory of law enforcement. You prosecute every crime, and then crime disappears.
Oh, Pat Truman, I wish we had more time. Such a big problem that there cannot be enough minutes dedicated to it. President and CEO of the National Center on Sexual Exploitation, thanks for joining us today on Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, sitting in for Tony Perkins. Coming up next, a victory out of the University of Iowa, where a federal judge decided that officials could be personally liable for patent religious discrimination. I'll talk to Daniel Blomberg, an attorney with the Beckett Law Firm, coming up next.
We live in a time of great political division, and this division only intensifies during campaign season. The toxic tone in politics can be discouraging, which makes it a very real temptation for many Christians to wipe their hands of politics altogether. After all, if God is sovereign and controls the heart of the king, as Proverbs says, do we really need to get involved in the messy world of politics? Because political engagement can be divisive, shouldn't Christians abandon politics and direct their energies toward more spiritual pursuits? Christians are called to submit every area of their life to God, which includes how they engage in politics. But they are called to engage biblically. This requires Christians to be prepared to follow their political theology to its logical end and vote for candidates and parties that support clear biblical values. For more information on the Christians' call to engage in politics, visit frc.org/engage. That's frc.org/engage.
News. We can get it from many sources, but what can you trust these days? Where can you get news that doesn't make you as suspicious as you are informed? If you're looking for something better, for honest coverage of the latest news, one trusted news source I look to is the Washington Times. When preparing for the radio program and selecting guests to join me on the show, I will often read the Washington Times and have their reporters join me here on the program because I trust how they cover the news. Join me and more than 7 million readers who turn to the Washington Times every month to get real, trusted news. For a limited time only, listeners of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins will receive a special annual rate of $69.95 for the first year. Subscribe to the Washington Times and get this special offer by using my name and visiting washingtontimes.com/Tony Perkins. That's washingtontimes.com/Tony Perkins.
Are you a student? Do you know a student? Well, this year, students can apply for scholarships to attend FRC Action's Values Voter Summit at no cost. At VVS, students will join thousands of like-minded conservatives who care about the issues that are shaping our nation. They'll enjoy our Student Mixer Trivia Night, topics covering everything from history to politics to the upcoming 2020 election. They'll hear from key conservatives, including Ali Stuckey, Congressman Mark Meadows, Dana Lash, and more. They'll have the opportunity to pursue influential jobs and internships with reputable organizations at our job fair meet and greet. Students will also have the chance to learn how to impact our world by attending our student breakout sessions. From October 11th to 13th, come to Washington, D.C. for Values Voter Summit. This is one weekend no student should miss. Learn more about scholarships by visiting valuesvotersummit.org/students or by calling 1-877-372-2808.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships, sitting in for Tony Perkins today. Well, a vice president and other officers at the University of Iowa must pay out of pocket for discriminating against InterVarsity Christian Fellowship, an evangelical campus group. An InterVarsity v. United University of Iowa, a federal court ruled that the university and its officers violated the law when they kicked InterVarsity off campus for having the audacity to ask its leaders to be, wait for it, Christians. A dozen other religious groups, including Sikhs, Muslims, Latter-day Saints, were also kicked off campus for requiring their leaders to share their faith. But all secular groups and a few religious groups favored by the university got a pass. Joining me now to talk about the case is Daniel Blomberg, an attorney with Beckett Law. Daniel, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thank you, Sarah. It's good to be here.
Well, first of all, I have to congratulate you on this compelling victory. We like to celebrate the fact that there are some sane judges in the world, and justice has definitely been served. In a ruling last Friday, the federal court said that this discrimination was so egregious, the officers would be personally liable, and even left open the possibility that the president, Bruce Harreld, could also be found liable. Were you surprised by how overwhelming this victory was? This was not just a home run. This was outside the grandstands.
You know what? I wasn't. And here's why. Not because these cases are easy. They're not. And not because the stakes are low. They're not. They're high stakes. The reason why I expected the judge to give us this ruling is twofold. One, the judge is fair. And two, the facts are egregious. The judge was absolutely right. We're talking about a situation where the InterVarsity Christian Fellowship was on this campus for 25 years, an award-winning part of the campus, one of the more diverse groups on campus. They have all sorts of students from all sorts of backgrounds who are welcome to all of their events. They want everybody there. And the only thing they ask is that the students who lead the prayers of the group believe in the God they're praying to. That's it. Because that's who they are, right? They are a religious group. They're a Christian group. This defines them. And the university got that for 25 years, and it respected that. And it respects it for all sorts of other groups, right? So an ideological group, a group that's committed to the issue of protecting the environment. Well, they can require their leaders to actually believe in protecting the environment. A political group that's committed to the ideology of the Republican or Democrat Party or whatever, what have you, can insist that their leaders and their members hold those views. Fraternities and sororities, which are the biggest groups on campus, the groups that the university itself markets to students, they can insist that not only their leaders but also their members be men or be women. Right? The university has a reasonable way that it's implemented its policy in the past. It's allowed students to gather around the core mission or core identity that kind of reflects the purpose of the group. But then they came after the religious folks. They kicked off InterVarsity. They kicked off the Muslim groups. They kicked off the Sikh groups. They kicked off the LDS groups. They kicked off the Chinese Christian groups. And they said, the reason why we're kicking you off, the only reason why we're kicking you off is because you ask your leaders to believe in the God that you believe in. That's crazy. No reasonable person thinks that you should be able to do that to a religious group. That destroys who they are.
It's so patently hostile to religion that there really could have been, in my view, no other outcome. And how they acted absolutely shocked me. So they claimed that InterVarsity had violated the university's non-discrimination policy and went on to freeze the bank account, limit access to campus, shut down the website, and then advertise it was defunct for lack of student interest. I mean, it really, they went above and beyond to make sure that they were communicating the message. So the judge here had some very compelling things to say in her order. She called this baffling, which, again, such an encouragement to those of us who go, oh, thankfully, somebody understands when an action is overtly hostile to religion. So are you anticipating any kind of personal monetary award if you had to venture an educated guess? What kind of dollar amount are we looking at against these officials?
Well, that's exactly what the judge ruled. The judge ruled that these officials who made this choice, who knowingly chose to kick off the religious groups while treating the other groups better, and they did that after the judge had already told them several times that that's unconstitutional, that they shouldn't do that. Those officials were found to be personally liable for the damage they caused to InterVarsity, which was substantial. Listen, I sat there in the deposition and I saw the student leader crying as she was being told by her own university's attorneys that her religious beliefs violated federal and state civil rights law, that they wanted some sort of special dispensation to discriminate against other students, which is the furthest thing from the truth. They welcome everybody in their meetings. This was a very, very hard thing. I mean, these students, they're not going to college so they can get in a lawsuit with their university, right? Who, many places, many situations, it's also their employer. Hey, nobody wants to have to get crosswise with the people who are grading their papers and the people who are signing their paycheck.
Exactly.
They're just there for an education. And so, what the judge did was what common sense required. And the law is really clear. Government servants, they have a tough job. It can be difficult sometimes to figure out what the law requires. But what the law says is when you violate a clearly established right and you do what no reasonable person would do, you know what? There's no protection for you. You're liable for what you did. And that's what the judge ruled here. She said, listen, everybody knows you can't treat religious people differently just because they're religious. You can't discriminate against them. But you did it anyway after I told you not to. So you're liable.
We've got a couple of seconds left here. Are you hopeful that this outcome will send a strong message to students on other college campuses and other college administrators?
Absolutely.
Listen, this is a simple constitutional violation. It was a selective application of the law. And we're applauding with you for this victory, and not just a legal victory, but the victory of common sense in this circumstance. Daniel Blomberg, attorney with Beckett Law, has been my guest. You are listening to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, sitting in for Tony Perkins. TonyPerkins.com. Coming up next, a Virginia teacher was fired for not using a trans student's preferred pronouns. He was fired and is now suing the school district. I'll talk with Caleb Dalton, the Alliance Defending Freedom attorney, on the case.
Radical abortion laws in New York, Illinois, and Vermont are challenging the sanctity of life. These laws have lifted the few existing restrictions on abortion in the name of family planning and mental health of pregnant mothers. Americans need to take a stand and defend the rights of the unborn. Family Research Council is sending Congress 90,000 baby hats as a reminder that babies should be welcomed with love and warmth, not potential danger. Supporters have already funded over 45,000 hats. We are over halfway there. Join Americans across the nation and donate $9 to send a powerful reminder that young lives need to be cherished. When you take action, we'll send you an end birthday abortion certificate that will remind you to pray for born alive babies who are facing the danger of being killed outside the womb. Visit endbirthdayabortion.com for more information. That's endbirthdayabortion.com.
Are you concerned with the state of our nation? Do you want to protect and promote religious freedom, the sanctity of life, free speech, and our children's educations? Today we see a growing threat against our values on the news, on our college campuses, in our elementary schools, at our public libraries, and in our courts. Every year in Washington, D.C., thousands of conservatives attend FRC Action's Values Voters Summit. From October 11th to the 13th, come to our nation's capital to mingle with and hear from key conservatives who are bringing real change to Washington, D.C. And learn how you can, too. FRC President Tony Perkins will be there, along with Ali Stuckey, Bill Bennett, Dana Lash, Oliver North, and U.S. House and Senate leaders. The 2020 elections are right around the corner, so this is one weekend you won't want to miss. We provide free scholarships for students. Register online at valuesvotersummit.org or call 1-877-372-2808. That's 1-877-372-2808.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, sitting in for Tony Perkins on this Wednesday afternoon. A Virginia teacher who was fired for not agreeing to call a female student he and him has filed a complaint against the school board that dismissed him. Peter Vlaming, a former French teacher at West Point High School in Williamsburg, Virginia, filed the complaint in the Circuit Court for the County of King William on Monday. And joining me now to talk about the case is Caleb Dalton, attorney with the Alliance Defending Freedom, who is representing Peter Vlaming. Caleb, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Sarah, thanks so much for having me.
Well, Caleb, I think your name is an apt one, right? So biblical namesake who spied out the promised land and assured Moses that Israel would defeat the enemy. You're taking on a task of looking out over the land and determining whether or not this is a case suitable for this individual plaintiff. And I have to tell you, from where I sit and all those of us here at FRC, we were so encouraged to learn that he had decided to bring suit. I am amazed that a school thinks they can compel the speech of a teacher. So that had to enter into the equation when determining whether or not to bring this to court.
It really did. The core issue is that nobody should be forced to contradict their core beliefs just to keep their job. You hit the nail on the head right there. I mean, this is a matter for all Americans. It shouldn't be one that people who just agree or disagree with Peter's beliefs. This is an issue of freedom for everybody and really establishing the principle that tolerance is a two-way street, that teachers, public school teachers, shouldn't be forced to contradict their core beliefs just to keep their job.
So in the complaint itself, you have mentioned violation of his constitutional, statutory, and contractual rights when they decided to fire him last year. So for those of us who are listening who are not attorneys, can you expound a little bit on what you mean by that?
Absolutely. So his right to free speech is really a core issue right here. The government under the Constitution, and we're specifically the Virginia Constitution here, but the principles apply broadly, can't force citizens
to speak a message that they disagree with. This was actually established years ago in a case where Jehovah's Witness students objected to saluting the flag and saying the Pledge of Allegiance. And we're all patriotic, but that's actually core to the fundamental freedoms in America, that the government doesn't force you to be patriotic, right? And the Supreme Court established that principle. They said the government can't force you to speak a message by word or by deed. And that's what West Point was trying to do to Peter here. They were trying to force him to speak a message that violated his faith.
Well, I love how you wrote that this was a crusade to compel conformity. Truer words were never spoken. It was an excellent summation of the whole case. What is Peter Vlaming asking for in this lawsuit?
The main thing he wants is to establish that core principle that we just talked about, to really protect the rights of all teachers and public employees, to help them be able to live and work in the public workspace without fear of losing their job because they can't violate their conscience. That's what he's looking for, and that's what we hope the court will recognize in this case, is that core fundamental principle that tolerance is a two-way street. The government shouldn't be compelling us to speak an ideological message and compel that conformity that you just talked about.
And let's talk a little bit about the relief that he's asking for in this case. What are some of the specific legal demands?
Sure. The primary demand is a declaration. We're asking the court to declare that this is unconstitutional. And that's really what he wants, is to establish that principle. But we're also asking for damages to compensate him. He was fired from his job. He wasn't able. He has four children. I mean, this has been tough for him and his family. He wasn't able to find a job in education. There were other openings for French teachers, but he applied for them and it was turned down specifically, not because he's not a great teacher. I think the record's clear on that. But he was turned down because of what the school board did to him in this case. So also looking for damages, but really trying to establish that core principle of tolerance and get a declaration that this is unconstitutional.
So his primary beef was that he did not want to use biologically inaccurate pronouns in the student's presence. I mean, he would even use the masculine name that this individual student chose, as you're allowed to choose your name in high school language classes. He would use that without a problem. It was just an absence of using the particular male pronouns. And so for my mind, I really do find this to be a confounding prospect on the part of the school board, who said that he was engaging in discriminatory conduct and creating a hostile learning environment. And I think the students who organized the walkout to protest his firing would say that the hostility was against Mr. Vlaming.
It really was. Peter went out of his way to accommodate the student. He created an environment as much as he could that was welcoming. And he, as you may know, obviously you pointed out he was using the preferred name. That was an accommodation. He also allowed the entire French class, they use French names in class, and he allowed the entire class to choose a new name so that she wouldn't feel singled out because she was picking a new masculine sounding name. So he did. He went out of his way to accommodate this student, but and it really went a mile to accommodate her, and the school board wouldn't give him an inch.
Oh, Caleb Dalton with Alliance Defending Freedom is the attorney who was representing Peter Vlaming in Virginia. Thanks so much for being with us today on Washington Watch. Well, I am Sarah Perry sitting in for Tony Perkins, and I have a special guest coming up next, Michelle Malkin, who has written a new book entitled Open Borders, Inc., Who's Funding America's Destruction? Follow the money, find the truth. She puts her mantra to work with a shocking deep dive dossier of the funders and foot soldiers of anarchy in the U.S. and around the globe. What she found will surprise and shock you. I'll have her coming up next on Washington Watch.
Hello, this is Tony Perkins, President of the Family Research Council here in Washington, D.C. I want to invite you to join Luana and myself, along with Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin, former Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann, for FRC's Israel Tour, June the 2nd through June the 12th, 2020. Whether you're sailing on the Sea of Galilee, standing in the ruins of Capernaum, or journeying up to Jerusalem, Israel is unlike any other place on earth. You'll relive the final earthly days of Jesus as you pray in the Garden of Gethsemane. You look upon Golgotha and stand in the Garden Tomb. The reality of his story will come alive in a transformative way. This one-of-a-kind tour will not only allow you to explore the land of the Bible and the roots of our Christian faith, you'll also hear firsthand from some of Israel's political, defense, and religious leaders. Join us June the 2nd through June the 12th for this life-changing experience. For more information, visit TonyPerkins.com or call 844-872-5155.
Planned Parenthood is not pro-woman. For decades, the nation's leading abortion supplier has claimed to be the champion of women's rights, but nothing could be farther from the truth. Planned Parenthood has repeatedly violated the law and violated women, from aiding and abetting sex traffickers, covering up child sexual abuse, and selling the remains of aborted baby parts, to ignoring the devastating effects that abortion has on women's physical and mental health. From its racist eugenic roots to the targeting of vulnerable communities, Planned Parenthood is an organization that not only promotes a culture of death, but makes it a reality. In a new brochure from FRC, you will find evidence that will challenge your assumptions about Planned Parenthood and equip you with the information you need to be a true champion for women and the lives of unborn children. To order this brochure and to download your free digital copy, visit frc.org/Planned Parenthood.
It's almost that time of year. FRC Action's annual Values Voter Summit is just around the corner, but there is still time to register. Join thousands of like-minded conservatives who, just like you, care about the state of our nation and want to do their part in protecting and promoting religious freedom and the sanctity of life, free speech, and marriage and the family. From October 11th through the 13th, come to Washington, D.C. to attend FRC Action's Values Voter Summit and hear from key conservatives who are bringing real change to Washington. And learn how you can too. FRC Action President Tony Perkins will be there along with Ali Stuckey, Bill Bennett, Dana Lash, Oliver North, and Congressman Mark Meadows. The 2020 elections are fast approaching, so this is one weekend you won't want to miss. Ask about our scholarship for students. Register online at valuesvotersummit.org or call 1-877-372-2808. That's 1-877-372-2808.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I am Sarah Perry, sitting in for Tony Perkins on this Wednesday edition, and I am very excited to talk to my next guest. Follow the money, find the truth is her individual journalistic mantra. And in her stunning new book, Open Borders, Inc., Who is Funding America's Destruction, she puts it to work. And she's produced a shocking deep dive dossier of the funders and foot soldiers of immigration anarchy here and around the world. And what she found will shock you. She writes that corporations are making gobs of money on the backs of illegal aliens, refugees, and low-wage guest workers. Politicians want cheap votes or cheap labor. Church leaders want pew fillers and collection plate donors. Social justice militants, my favorite segment of the populace, working with corporate America, want to silence free speech they deem hateful while raking in tens of millions, promoting mass uncontrolled immigration. So that's a lot to think about. And she has put together a stunning 500-page tome on precisely how this system works. Michelle joined Conservative Review as a senior editor and CRTV as the host of Michelle Malkin Investigates. She is a mother, wife, blogger, conservative syndicated columnist, author of 7 books, countless op-eds, and her first car was a stick shift with no air conditioning. Truth be told, she is a member of the left-handed club, that is. Who are said to be smarter than everybody else? Michelle, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thank you, Sarah, for having me. I appreciate it.
So while we might think we understand the issue of the border, because it is everything in the news right now, the need to secure it, looking through your comprehensive book, I realize that we've really only seen the tip of the iceberg. Your appendices alone comprise 150 pages of the book. This is so essential to people who have an interest in understanding not only the idea and the concept and the regulations behind immigration itself, but also some of the left's biggest movers and shakers, because they're inexorably tied to this issue of immigration, aren't they?
They are, and it is important that people familiarize themselves with the very groups and organizations that are seeking to sabotage American sovereignty. Many of them are familiar to your listeners because over the years, these very same groups have targeted people of faith and organizations like yours, and they have put them on so-called hate lists because many of these propagandists understand if you weaponize this concept of hate. In other words, if you turn political opposition into ammunition that will then be used to ban people from the public square, turn them into public menaces that should not be allowed to participate online, then it's an easy way to defeat your political enemies, all while enjoying tax-exempt nonprofit status. And that is the case with many of these Soros organizations that are militantly partisan and militantly open borders. So those are the connections that I make in the book. And I want people to understand that when they see the signs of immigration anarchy in their daily lives, for example, the headlines that you refer to, every single day there's a story about how illegal alien sanctuary policies are endangering Americans and law-abiding citizens and families. This is not some accident. It's because the Hungarian billionaire George Soros has specifically targeted district attorney races. He's funded judges. He's funded secretaries of state, police chiefs, who have a radical agenda to undermine every aspect of immigration enforcement. And particularly over the last 3 years, Sarah, the goal here is to obstruct the White House from achieving any success in this area of regaining control of our country.
So I find this fascinating because you really did begin the book in a way that was so compelling, but also memorable, because it sets the stage for, again, not just the immigration issue, but really the MO of the hard progressive left. And you talk about the Make America Disappear agenda, MADA. Very clever counterpart to MAGA. This is MADA. And you actually lay out the particular steps that the left uses, beginning with the children. And I find very interesting the SPLC's use of the teaching tolerance platform, which they like to push in from a backdoor standpoint through the teachers union, with whom they partner explicitly. And you name some of these other big name actors. You also mentioned George Soros, the CEO of Open Borders. You talk a little bit about his motivation to fundamentally change the conception of what America is. And in fact, your book begins with a tremendous quote from George Soros. "The critical issue of our time is how to overcome the obstacles posed by national sovereignty to the pursuit of the common interest." In other words, throw open the doors, and then we'll see what happens. So what are some other motivations with someone, a billionaire like George Soros, who has so much money but is driven by this concept of an open borders policy?
It's a lot about control. And it's an ideologically driven agenda that also happens to line the pockets of many of Soros' organizations and his allies. And a lot of that money isn't just from the Open Society Foundation. George Soros has earmarked $18 billion of his $25.2 billion of net worth towards achieving this agenda. But they leverage all of that money. It is passed down and laundered and recycled among other organizations that have these anodyne names to them. And many of them also are getting billions of dollars in taxpayer subsidies. In other words, he's found a brilliant way for the American people to, very, very eerily subsidize their own destruction. And there are unfortunately many left-wing church organizations that are in cahoots with them. There are financial incentives involved for them as well. The refugee resettlement racket, which is, the prime agenda of the United Nations, which is bent on redistributing the world's inhabitants within our own borders, is a billion-dollar racket that enriches a number of lucrative government contractors. A lot of this involves the perversion of scripture and the idea that welcoming the stranger means that we should welcome every last willing migrant and worker into the country, when any sovereign nation has the right of self-determination to determine what numbers of the people we should bring in here is, so how many, where they're from, what values they have, what skills they have. I'm not against immigration. My parents were immigrants from the Philippines in 1970. They came here legally. They had to learn how to speak English. They had to show loyalty and fealty to our laws and our constitution. And over the last 30 years, we've lost complete control over that kind of system that has brought joy and so many bounties, not only to the families who've been blessed to be able to come into this country, but, you know, to the rest of the country as well. And the whole idea of assimilation has completely been abandoned in favor of mass illegal alien amnesty.
So I want to talk a little bit and shift gears, talk about what you deem to be the A-team, which I love. Again, these sort of simplistic explanations for very complicated concepts that for those of us who don't follow policy on a regular basis, it really sets in motion our complete understanding of what has proven to be a very newsworthy, very controversial topic. But let's talk about the A-team. You talk a little bit about Abolish ICE, Antifa, Sanctuary Anarchists. What's their role in all of this?
Disruption and erasure of the very fundamental difference between legal and illegal immigration to this country. Many of these groups, Antifa groups, particularly in the Pacific Northwest, where I've just been recently on my book tour, have incited violence against Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents. They have threatened other employees of the Department of Homeland Security. And remember that we could build the highest wall and the longest wall along our southern border and our northern border, for that matter, but people will get in. And so you can see how important the function of ICE is, because there are three duties that they have: to detect people who don't belong here, to detain them, and to deport them. And Abolish ICE and Antifa and what I call Sanctuary Anarchists, these are the people who don't wear black masks on the street. They wear black robes on the bench. These are the radical left-wing judges who use their power and abuse it, sitting in, you know, their high courts and exercising their power that doesn't belong to them to issue nationwide injunctions from their little courtrooms to bollocks up and throw monkey wrenches into President Trump's agenda of introducing immigration enforcement measures that would stop the revolving door of criminal aliens being caught and released, and in determining what the proper numbers of refugees is in this country, and in trying to turn off all of the magnets that are bringing illegal aliens, inducing them to come across the border and do things like pay coyotes to have their children or grandchildren pair up with some complete stranger and then lie about being family members at the border, because they know if they do that, they'll get caught and released too.
Right. All right. So tell me about who of some of these guilty corporate handmaidens are that you talk about in Appendix E, which, again, it's so well researched. I want to remind our listeners, and available everywhere books are sold, online at Amazon and any other provider. You talk a little bit about corporate handmaidens. Who are these companies? Give us some examples, and where are they sending their money?
So a lot of the most prominent Open Borders Inc. members in the corporate community are based in Silicon Valley. And so you have Microsoft and Facebook and Google and Apple that have become openly militant. These are now companies that are run by social justice warriors who are refusing to do business with anybody in the Department of Homeland Security, who are funding legal cases and lawyers for illegal aliens who are suing our government, even though they don't belong here, for everything from subsidized abortions to welfare benefits to employment benefits and for the right to be able to stay here interminably in our country. It's astonishing that so many of these companies operate and enjoy all the benefits of being America-based businesses, mm-hmm. but do everything they can in their own power to sabotage American sovereignty.
You know, I find especially intriguing the notion that there are some donations we send to humanitarian organizations, faith-based groups, political entities that seem very benign, as you mentioned, but I think naturally humanitarian aid, an aid package sent from an organization that is supposed to be faith-based, you talk about how they are effectively aiding and abetting worldwide human smuggling. That's extremely discouraging, I think.
It is, and it's probably the most shocking of the chapters and the information that I include in the book. I was raised Catholic, but I was distressed by all of the billions of dollars that I traced from the Vatican and Pope Francis, who has been one of the most savage critics of President Trump and our efforts to get control of our immigration system. The U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops received billions of dollars in government subsidies. As a refugee resettlement contractor, they get money for foster care for illegal aliens, for a loan resettlement program that they help run. And many sub-organizations under the Catholic Church have been infiltrated by social justice leftists. And there's a former bishop in Chicago who partnered with Saul Alinsky, the infamous godfather of community organizing, to create permanent funding mechanisms for the social justice arm of the Catholic Church called the Catholic Campaign for Human Development. And that group, over the last 25 years, has lobbied for everything from illegal alien driver's licenses to in-state tuition discounts for illegal aliens to the blanket amnesties that many of these left-wing groups like the National Council of La Raza and the Council on American Islamic Relations have been pushing since the Bush years through the Obama Dreamer executive orders. And, of course, all of these groups now are united in opposing President Trump's efforts to undo the executive orders of Obama.
Michelle Melkin, author, commentator, journalist, wife, mom, blogger. She does a lot of things. This book, Open Borders, Inc., is 500 pages, 12 appendices and maps, billions of dollars traced, 400-plus nonprofits, religious charities. It is not just a necessary book. It is a well-researched book, and it will open your eyes, listeners. We encourage you to pick it up when you can. At the end of the day, this is about the rule of law, homeland security, and the future of free speech. I have been Sarah Perry, sitting in for Tony Perkins on Washington Watch, and I will be back with you all tomorrow.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is powered by the Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.